Hello, everyone. I'm Leslie Cornwell, certified nurse midwife with Midwifery Business Consultation. I have Izzy with Contemporary Insurance, and I would love for you to say your last name because I feel like every time I've attempted it, I slaughter it, so I apologize ahead of time. But Izzy has been a wealth of knowledge in the malpractice industry for midwives and advocate for how many years now? I know it's been in the 1980s, if I recall.
Almost 40 years.
Okay.
So even before it was popular.
Oh my gosh. Well, yes, you're a wealth of knowledge. So tell us a little bit about yourself, and we've talked about some great topics for today.
Sure. So it's Izzy Teitelbaum, and I'm the chairman of Contemporary Insurance Services. And we have a program that is devoted specifically to insuring midwives nationwide. There are a couple of three states where we don't. But the program has actually been designed from its beginning to be particularly sensitive to midwifery needs for such things like if a midwife wants to decide to do a vaginal birth after a C-section, there we go, it's a few seconds there. We don't ask about that, it's covered. We don't charge extra for it. If tail insurance is needed, the premium is reasonable. And just generally speaking, the policy respects midwives as professionals, making the decisions they need to make every day in their practices.
Awesome. I wish we had more wonderful resources like you and advocates that just want to educate and help, because I think it's about just giving options to our community. And I have so many midwives across the country. Their biggest fear when they look at a private practice and budget is a good chunk of how do I pay for my malpractice? How do I make it work? Just so many questions, because it's such a foreign thing that's not taught in school. So I'm grateful you're going to let me pick your brain today. We wanted to talk about just like malpractice insurance contracts, whether you're going to start your own private practice or you're going to join a team. How do you know what questions to ask?
That's a really great starting point. So let's start first with the assumption that most young midwives will actually work for somebody else before they start their own practices. And in that setting, very few are really prepared to know what to ask their employer for it. And I think the most important thing is that you need to have a meeting of minds between yourself and your future employer. And that meeting of minds should be reduced to a written contract. Now, I think everyone has heard the fact that a contract is best used when it sits in a drawer and does nothing. But if there is a disagreement between an employer and employee, it's good to have written terms. So let's start with the most basic term. Employer is talking to a prospective midwife about hiring her, and he says, sure, I'll pay for your malpractice insurance. Midwife is ecstatic, because usually that is what happens, actually, that employers do pay. Midwife works for the employer for 3-4 years. Everything is great. She gets a job offer that she feels is better than she has there. She announces that she's leaving. She gives the employer reasonable notice. He says, okay, goodbye. And she says, well, wait a minute. I just want to touch base with you about my malpractice insurance. I have a claims-made policy. With a claims-made policy, in order to lock that coverage down, there's one last premium payment called a tail. If we don't purchase the tail, all the coverage we've had for the last 4 years disappears. So I just need you to assure me that you're going to pay the tail. The employer says, well, wait a minute. I never promised you I would pay the tail. Midwife says, but you said you'd pay my practice insurance. Employer says, well, I have paid your malpractice insurance, but now that you're leaving, I don't feel any future obligation to you. So therefore, you're on your own for your tail. Tail, for if you're in a major city where premiums are high, a tail can be $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, all due within 60 days of policy cancellation. And now you have a problem because the contract was very clear. The contract said, I will pay your malpractice premium, but it didn't say anything about the sales. So it's very important that the contract that's written says, I'll pay your malpractice insurance, and if you leave, I'll pay for your tail. Now, many doctors or many employers will say, I'm not sure I want to do that. I'm willing to hire you, and I'm willing to pay for your coverage. And because the current coverage, which is the kind of coverage that doesn't need a tail, may not be available, I'll pay the claims paid, but I don't want to have to be burdened with a heavy tail if you leave after 1 year. So that makes you economically not a good choice for me. So there are alternatives. What the midwife can say is, okay, look, if I stay with you for 1 year, you pay 20% of my tail. If I stay for 2 years, you pay 40. If I stay for 5 years, you pay 100%. Because I've given you good use of my time. I've shown you loyalty, and you handle it on that basis. And the employer might say yes, which would be great, and then you want that in the contract that says that they're going to pay it. The employer might say no, but at least you know what you're walking into. Or maybe the employer will make a counteroffer. I'll do it over 10 years, 10% a year instead of 20%. Or maybe we'll work really hard to find an occurrence policy. Maybe there is one in our neighborhood. So that is a really important factor. And what it does, among other things, is it provides peace of mind for the midwife and a future projection for the employer, so the employer knows exactly what he or she is getting into when they make that employment offer.
Yeah, I think it's so important because I think as new midwives, we've got grad school debt, we're younger, and we just are like, how much are they going to pay us? What's the salary? And I'm such a huge advocate with starting midwifery business consultation. Like, let's look at the employment contract. Let's look at the benefits. How much negotiation room? Like, whenever I worked at past hospitals, I was always a challenge for them to negotiate because I asked questions probably the average midwife didn't ask. And I find bigger organizations, it's harder to negotiate those terms versus a private, smaller practice just because they're using their own funds versus it's a pool and it's a bigger system but you always can try. And at least, like you said, knowing the terms, ask for a copy of a sample policy that you'd be going and have someone like you to go to and go over it with, even if you don't quite understand it. Just like we go to a lawyer for a legal contract. If we have a malpractice insurance contract, you want to go to the experts to clarify. I know you brought that up the last meeting that you were more than happy to help midwives with clarification questions.
That's right. We don't charge for our time. Obviously, we'd like to see a policy purchased through us, but it's not necessary. If someone's in serious negotiations with an employer and they need advice, all they need to do is call me. I'm happy to offer that advice but to build a relationship.
Awesome. Awesome. So what are other things besides a tail? I know that's a big one that blindsides a lot of midwives because very few places, because it is the expensive part and that difference of renting versus, oh, I didn't realize if I don't work there till retirement, like I only get it for that time. What are other great terms or questions to ask when you're in that negotiation process?
So part of it also is an understanding between the employer and the midwife on what's expected. So for example, some employers will hire midwives, but don't want them to do delivery. They're just doing regular female care. Some of the employers actually want them to do deliveries, which is, of course, what most midwives probably want to do. But I think the important thing is to understand office protocols. And that's usually the kind of thing that you're not going to get the answer you need by asking the questions. And so, you know, what's important is if there are other midwives in the practice, you should ask the employer, do you mind if I speak to the other midwife to practice, just get an idea of what their feeling is. And if it's an open office with an open employer, the answer should always be, oh, certainly. Let's get to the point where you're about to accept that offer. And then once you tell me that you're ready to accept the offer, now that might become sensitive if you're being hired because someone else is being fired and they haven't been told yet. But short of that, you should be able to get an idea. And it's important to know. So, example, is the office going to permit you to do VBACs if you think a VBAC is the most important thing to do? What are some of the standards of care to the office? How many deliveries does that office do based on the number of personnel? You want to get a comfort level with everything. You keep in mind that a regular OB practice usually has far, far more volume than a regular midwifery practice. So don't get so disturbed by those numbers. But the question is, how many deliveries are you expected to do? Another example would be often an OB group will hire a midwife to handle hospital births. What basically is happening is that the midwife is stationed in the hospital, has no relationship with the patients that are coming in. She is essentially a hospitalist.
The laborist model, yeah.
And, mm-hmm. Right, and that actually runs so contrary to what most midwives want to do in their practice, that you need to have an understanding what it is. So what you're doing is triage. All right, not horrible, but But if you're actually delivering midwives, I mean, delivering babies for mothers that you've never met before, that's horrible. Number one, are you going to be able to get the full file before the delivery occurs? Is this a mother that's never had care except when she walks into the delivery room? And because one of the things that's important for all midwives to manage is risk. One of the things that happens when you apply for coverage is that a company is going to want to know your claims history. And if you're in a risky setting, where, for example, you're just delivering mothers maybe 10 a week that have never seen a midwife or a physician until the day of the delivery, you have no idea what the risk factors are, and you're suddenly putting yourself in a position where you're going to be possibly sued because there's an increased likelihood of a bad outcome.
No, I agree wholeheartedly. A lot of times, if you're more local, you're going to go on site having a few hours to shadow, and then you can hint at some of those questions. I a lot of times would ask, okay, can I look at the scope of practice? Can I look at the collaboration? Can I look at the hospital privileges? Because I've seen a lot of places where I'm like, okay, that's not independent scope of a midwife. They're like, well, this is what's going to be expected of you. So you can instantly see, okay, how much risk am I going to put? Because I think sometimes we think so much of the paycheck. We don't think of the long term. Our license in many states, you have to worry for quite a long time after a birth. It's not just leave there. And I mean, some of the states, it's 18, 20 years. So you have to look. Obstetrics, unfortunately, is a high risk specialty to choose from. And even though we're midwives and we tend to have a good relationship and we tend to take low risk, when you're joining a hospital practice, you may be in-house in a small community hospital and there's nobody else around and you're it. So sometimes you want to ask, like, what are your backup? Is there somebody in-house? What are your resources if you need help? Because if you have an obstetrician, you're joining his team, but the last midwife left because she couldn't get a hold of him at 2 a.m. and needed some additional assistance, that it's not just about the contract, but it's also the professional scope and job description you're signing up for.
That's right. I will tell you actually a horror story that we had many, many years ago. We had a midwife that had a collaborating physician, and it was a father-son collaborating physician, and everything was really, really doing well. The midwife had an amazing relationship with the father. But one day the father was on vacation, and midwife had an emergency. And she called the son, and the son said, I'm sorry, I'm not interested, I'm not coming, you're on your own. That turned into an over $1 million lawsuit against the midwife that she lost because she had provided for care, and the outcome was so bad they were afraid to take it to a jury. So it's really important to know what you have, especially also to become familiar with your venues. So for example, if you're in the five boroughs of New York, you know that the risk of a suit is greater and the likelihood of a bad outcome in a jury trial is greater. So if you're doing that, or rather if you're in one of the small islands of Hawaii where everybody knows everybody and you're going to get a jury that's probably more likely to be favorable to you, you need to know those things about your community.
Are there easy statistics to look like? If I'm a brand new midwife, I am young, single, I can move anywhere in the country. Is there a database or somewhere to reference or at least a resource to say these tend to be more of the higher litigation areas, or is it very scattered throughout the United States?
So that's actually an amazing question. And it's amazing because the answer is certainly yes, but the real answer is no. It's my job as a malpractice insurance broker to best serve my client's needs. So when a client calls me and says, I need to make a decision, and should I pick a venue based on where? And my answer is no. Pick a venue on where you think your business is going to be best served. Everything will have economies of scale. If you're doing deliveries in New York, you're probably being paid more for delivery than if you're doing a delivery in Hawaii. And so at the end of the day, the economies of scale will work for you. Having said that, risk management and how you practice and how you take patients is affected by the jurisdiction you're in. I was speaking with a doctor yesterday that we insure outside in a different program, and the question became, she actually had a patient where she had a bad outcome with the patient, and actually it was a basically the baby had to be transferred. Actually, I take it back. It was a midwife, not a doctor. The baby had to be transferred. And baby was fine. Patient was unhappy about the transfer. Hired a doc, hired a lawyer, or lawyer hired her. And they sued the doc, they sued the midwife. And so my comment to the midwife was, are you going to take this patient back? Well, I've done this for 40 years. I will tell you that I've heard from many midwives that they say, hey, patient's suing me, but she's still coming. She's still in my practice. I've delivered three of her babies. This one we had a problem with, and I may deliver three more of her babies. So having said that, each and every case has to be reviewed on its own. In this particular case, because baby was healthy afterwards, and the real problem that the mom had was she wanted to deliver at home and she didn't want to have a transfer to the hospital. But the midwife, exercising her professional judgment, said, it's time to go. We need a transfer. And then, so the mother had a little bit of a difficult time in that birth. And lawyer basically argued, well, because I had some distress, I want you to pay me a certain amount of money. And if you don't pay me this amount of money, I'm going to take it to court. That's a litigious patient. That patient didn't stand up to the lawyer and say, wait a minute, I like this midwife. She did good work. Not all deliveries can be finished at home. And in that situation, my recommendation is that not to take the patient back.
I think you bring up a good talk, because we've went the direction of if you're joining a hospital practice, you're joining a private practice and being employed. But if you're doing the direction of yourself, starting your own private practice, hiring a team, it's just as much importance on the malpractice side as choosing which clients are good within your scope, like policies and protocols, having that risk reduction side. So is there any other great examples you have as far as not just looking at the malpractice, but things that a private midwife starting own birth center, home birth practice could think about to reduce her liability risk?
So it's very important to stay educated. There are lots of courses out there. I mean, everyone has a certain amount of required coursework they have to take in every state to keep their license. But one should focus in some cases on simple risk management courses. And if there isn't one available for midwives, I would look for one that's offered to physicians. Just how do you best manage your practice? So obviously there's some basic issues. Record keeping is extremely important, whether you have electronic health records or non-electronic health records, that you maintain detailed notes that are contemporaneously recorded. You know, they don't have to be right that second, but by the end of the day, you should be recording the file and updating the file, because there's nothing that will help a defense better than a good contemporaneous medical record. Never make promises you can't keep. You know, if a patient says to you, I want a home birth, and if it doesn't work, I still want a home birth. You know, and she's adamant about it. You need to sit her down and educate her. Running an office, you know, if you're a solo midwife, it's going to be hard sometimes to do the admin and everything else, but you can't afford to hire someone to do the admin. So you've got to pace yourself. You can't overload yourself with patients. You've got to leave time to do the admin work. And then the very last thing is just, and this is really of nature to midwives, good conversation with patients, good dialogue, follow up after something went wrong. It's a good thing. If you call and say, hey, I just want to check in. You had our time yesterday. Don't be afraid to be wrong. You know, midwives make mistakes. Everyone makes mistakes. And don't be afraid to apologize for something. And, you know, people say don't ever apologize. Don't apologize for saying I made a mistake. Although that's something we could talk about as a whole other conversation. But you can apologize for outcomes. I'm really sorry you went through this distress. I'm really sorry that you had anxiety. And as far as outcomes, in most cases, if there's a mistake, the midwife doesn't have to acknowledge the mistake. She can't really care about the outcome. The truth of the matter is, the lawyers have to decide whether it was a mistake or not, not the midwife, when it comes to admitting fault. So that's a whole, like I say, separate discussion. But there's nothing wrong with apologizing for outcomes.
Well, I think it's important when you brought up the direction of real-time charting, because we get tired, we get exhausted, we did office all day and then birth at night, and then you're like, oh, I'll do it in a couple days, and then your memory isn't as good, and at the moment, okay, now 2 days later, she's got an infection and XYZ is happening. Your judgment's going to change on what that record, because you knew the end outcome. At the moment, you didn't. You based your knowledge and your decision-making on what you knew at that time. And I think that sometimes is forgotten, where sometimes unpredictable things happen and you want your documents to show you followed everything because she was low risk and healthy at that time. Now XYZ complication happened. You don't want to try to bias your record defensively, because it makes it look worse. And if you have any more suggestions on that.
I think that's great. I think the only question I would extend that to is the question of telehealth. How do you do your record keeping in telehealth? How do you do your patient relationships in telehealth? And then clearly, because of the pandemic now, telehealth is becoming all that more, much more important in order to reach patients and to provide services where they're necessary. So I think one of the things that you need to keep in mind is that the same things that you would think about when you're negotiating with an employer, you have to think about when you're negotiating with a telehealth provider. Now let's break this into two pieces. One is telehealth that you're providing on your own through a platform that is not a telehealth provider. It just facilitates telehealth. And the other is when you're working for a telehealth provider, for example, like a Teladoc or a Maven or one of these other operations. And they will sometimes offer you malpractice insurance. You should just inquire about the nature of that malpractice insurance. What happens when you're not working with them? Some of them will actually charge $10 to $12 per call if you don't have your own insurance, so that you end up having a cost-effective way of having coverage if you don't have your own. Some provide it to everyone without charge. Everyone's different, but you should just know what's there, what you're getting, and what happens if you stop working. Will the policy stay there forever? Protocols are the same. When you speak with a patient, you've got to have a chart that talks about exactly what you did. Now, the question becomes, who's keeping that chart, and where are you doing the chart? So in a sophisticated telehealth service where you're a provider to an organization that provides significant telehealth services, they will have their charting built in. It's very important to know that. It's very important to keep aware of things like HIPAA. So, for example, you know that contacts between you and patients is sheltered by HIPAA. You have to be very careful not to get it out. You need to understand, in anybody that you're speaking with, is your platform that you're having conversations with HIPAA compliant? Is it protecting you from a HIPAA breach? Because a HIPAA breach may sound small, but if the government comes after you for HIPAA breach, you could be talking about thousands and thousands of dollars of defense and some significant issues. There's a whole new area now of not malpractice insurance coverage, but coverage for HIPAA type of breaches. It's fairly inexpensive now, but it's going to get more and more expensive as we see more and more breaches of the internet and of information. So again, you do that. Now, if you're using a platform that is a HIPAA compliant platform, but it's not like a Maven or a Teladoc, and you're simply paying it to allow you to use its service so you can do telehealth, again, you want to make sure it's HIPAA compliant. You need to keep the medical records, because the platform will not provide, is likely not going to provide the records, which means all the requirements that you have are there. That raises the question, how about licensing? I'm sitting here, my office is here in Maryland, I'm a midwife, I decided to do telehealth in Florida, and I'm not licensed in Florida, but I'm not in Florida, but my patient's in Florida. Does it work? So there's a bunch of interesting answers to that question. Pre-pandemic, our advice was you do not want to offer services where you're not licensed, because two things will happen. One, if you actually upset somebody in that community enough to check on you, for example, let's say you have a patient that has an OB, and the OB says, it's no problem, don't worry about it, but the patient wants a little bit of second opinion and reaches out to a midwife, she says, yeah, you should worry about it. And that OB says, you're meddling and you're not even licensed here, files a complaint with the Bureau of Licensing or the Department of Licensing in Florida. There's a good chance that you will be charged with practicing medicine without a license in Florida. You'll have to defend yourself and could end up with a regulatory action against you. Post-pandemic, during the pandemic, is different. Many, many states, not all, have broadened access to the state by anyone who has a license in any one state. So if you have a license in Maryland and you want to see a patient in Florida, you can look up the Florida state's requirements for whether you, during the pandemic, you're allowed to provide services. And like I say, in most states, it's an easy lookup, and you'll find in many states that yes, you can provide either telehealth services or even more services than telehealth during the pandemic because there's a shortage of practitioners. So that is a very nice way of extending your practice as long as you find you can reach them to be able to provide those services. Again, you're still obligated to keep a medical record. You know, all the protocols are in place. There is a little bit of a touchy subject between what standards apply, because we all know that in lawsuits, it's community practice that applies. So if you're servicing somebody in Florida and you're in Maryland, more than likely it's the Florida community standards that will apply, and those may be different than the community standards in Maryland, particularly, for example, on issues like collaboration.
Well, I agree. I think anybody chooses functional medicine, telehealth, anything more on a larger scale national, you're not just having to keep up with your continuing education in your own state and regulations and the local standards. You have to know really well whatever state you decide to offer services to. So yeah, I think it's definitely, it's part of that business plan. It's part of that decision-making with your practice. You want to reduce the risk. You want to, you do a business plan so you don't get into it and you're like, oh crap, I didn't realize I couldn't do this state, this state, this state. That's why you spend so much time planning and prepping. I have so many midwives, it breaks my heart. They're like, well, I'm just going to do it and go with the flow. And then there's hardships and there's challenges. So yeah, I'm so grateful you spend this time just getting midwives to think about the direction of that business backdrop and whether it's your scope of practice, joining a team, whether it's a private practice. There's a lot of things I didn't even realize that you brought up today with the telehealth. So thank you.
My pleasure. I think the important thing is that in any business that one undertakes, whether it's in medicine or outside of medicine, you have to be strategic about it. You have to plan. You have to look at your risks. And managing risks is in American society is not something that should give you depression or pause, but something that you should consider wisely. Working with an attorney where appropriate is a wise thing to do. And at the end of the day, a business that you can't afford to start, maybe when you shouldn't start, having said that, most midwives can afford to start any new practice because the overhead is extremely low to start. Even if you're not doing home birth, even if you're opening an office, you can find an office that you would have that you pay by the hour. So the cost of opening an office for a midwife is really small, so it shouldn't be challenging. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't think about all the risks that are out there and how you manage those risks.
You know, my personal opinion, I think that midwives should really, there's too many out there running private practices without malpractice. And I just think just like life insurance and house and car, it's, you are your most valuable asset for a very long time. And I think, like, I loved what you said last time, like it's the masses. If we get more midwives to utilize malpractice, the cost will go down. It's based on the pool, not based on, so I think that advocacy and reinforcing, we as midwives need to join together to look at this risk analysis and say, okay, I'm going to look at X, Y, Z direction because it's going to help out my sister midwives with lower cost and time.
Correct. Also, when I point out one kind of aside, I was talking with a midwife yesterday who said, hey, I don't really need to worry so much about this risk because I formed an LLC or a corporation, so I'm protected by the LLC or the corporation. And the answer is, no, you're not. You're protected from slips and falls if someone walks into your office and slips. That you are, but professional liability can never be sheltered by a corporation. Professional liability is personal, attaches to you as a person, and you can never shelter yourself from it by setting up a corporation or any other form of entity.
Yeah, And I think that's part of the advocacy. I do a lot of resources for midwives about the different type of business entities and the S corp, the LLC, the C corp, the S corp, the nonprofit. And there's a lot of misunderstandings. If they choose to do an LLC, they're protected because it's limited liability. And people don't understand the business is limited liability. If you have a staff, you put protocols out, they don't follow it, they can sue the business. But if you directly are giving the care, you, and they sue you directly, they can sue the business and you. And so you have to really protect your personal assets. You have to have like even malpractice insurance and an umbrella. Like there's a lot of great strategies for protecting your personal assets and your business assets. And that's what I'm very passionate about. So I appreciate you bringing that up, Izzy.
Right. And I would actually add to that, that you need to keep in mind that a good attorney is clever and will always try to find a way to make something personal that might have been protected by a corporation. So for example, if a staff person does something, you may have some protection from the corporation, but a good attorney is going to try to put that on you and say that you were professionally inept in some way or negligent in some way. And so doing risk management, being careful, being well planned is a requirement of every business that extends beyond just you yourself.
Yeah, and I think that's right, especially like a good attorney. You maybe weren't directly involved, but maybe the protocol wasn't updated in 5 years, or vicarious liability. Each state has different regulatory requirements for their LLC. So if you're not doing your meeting minutes, you're not doing whatever things the state's requiring for that LLC, they're now going to say you were a negligent owner. So people, that breaching of that veil is so, so important to understand your state regulations. Just because you set up an LLC, you need to know what are those regulatory requirements for maintaining it every year.
That's correct.
So, well, thank you, Izzy. I could literally talk to you for hours. I appreciate your time. If you want to tell them how to get your resources, the best way to connect with you, I greatly appreciate it.
Sure. There are three ways you can reach out to us. You can reach out to us by phone at 301-933-3373. We have our website at cisinsurance.com. And my email is Izzy, which is I as an island, S as a Sam, I as an island, at cisinsurance.com. Call anytime, whether West Coast or East Coast, and we'd love to speak with you.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Izzy. You have a great rest of your day.
You too, Leslie. Bye-bye now.